I'm delighted that Dr. Frimmer is with us. He served as Principal Dean and Applied Professor of Ethics, or a Professor of Applied Ethics, I guess it's a bit different than that, at Waterloo Lutheran Seminary since 2005, ordained in the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Canada, and served parishes in Kingston and New Hamburg in Ontario. He was Executive Secretary for the denomination, and for close to 25 years served as Director of the Lutheran Office for Public Policy. This will come through in his considerations with us, such a wide, rich range of engagements with other religious communities and with politicians at the provincial, national, and international level. He served as chairperson of numerous ecumenical and multi-faith organizations, including the Canadian Council of Churches Commission on Justice and Peace, and was a founding member and chairperson of the Interfaith Social Assistance Coalition in Ontario. And he's represented the ELCIC on a wide range of ecumenical and multi-faith coalitions that have addressed issues of economic globalization, social and health policy, peace and disarmament, human rights, and the rights of First Peoples. He's represented the ELCIC on the Governing Council of the Lutheran World Federation and has been frequently a member of numerous elected observer, human rights, and ecumenical delegations to many parts of the world. He teaches at Waterloo Lutheran Seminary on the campus of Wilfrid Laurier University, and his research focus has been on a history of Canadian ecumenical social justice movements in Canada since World War II, and reclaiming the vocation of government and developing a new understanding of the public. And I would say, based on his lectures yesterday, reclaiming the vocation of the ecclesia, of the church. So please welcome Dr. Frimmer.
Thank you. It's nice to be in Edmonton. I must say it's a delightful city. I haven't been here for a number of years, and I've kind of gotten reacquainted over the last couple of days, and it's a great place. Nice to see some friends from the good old days, as they say, when you reach my age. They're all good old days, but it's nice to see many of you here that I've known from other incarnations in our life. Before I begin, maybe it would be helpful if we know sort of who's in the room. So rather than doing a kind of go-around, I'm going to just do some categories. You tell me, how many Lutherans do we have? Just raise your hands. Okay, so a fair number of Lutherans. How many clergy from any denomination? Okay, fair number of clergy. How many from outside Edmonton? From a couple from outside Edmonton? Okay. And how many from other faith groups other than Lutheran? Yeah. Okay, why don't you just name what those are? So let's start here.
Catholic.
Roman Catholic?
Christian Science.
Muslim. Are we here? Anglican?
Mennonite.
Good.
Christ.
Church of Christ?
Christian Reformed.
There were a couple hands back there, too. Don't be shy.
Unitarian.
Anybody else we missed?
United Church.
Good. Okay, that's helpful to me because as I give some illustrations, as David Goa mentioned, I have worked with most of your communities at some point. And we, you know, one of the things we don't understand in Canada, or don't remember in Canada, and I get a little weary of it, I'm going to be a bit cranky in my old age, is we don't realize how much faith groups and different churches do together in this country. It is exemplary in all the world. As David said, I've had the pleasure of traveling to many other places in Europe, South America, Africa. And here in Canada, we are a model for the world in the way our churches and the way faith groups collaborate, especially in a time when people want to be pretty dismissive of all of that. I want to say you're very fortunate to have someone like David Goa here and Dietmar Mundell, two great saints of this kind of work. Because today, one of the real challenges is the question of, it's raised right there, faith in public life. There are many people that want faith communities banished from what we used to refer to as the public square. What I refer to it as is the public commons. And today we're going to talk a little bit about that, why it's a precipitous moment for people of faith to think about what it is that we do in public. And I'm going to say more about that as we go along. As I have certain strong views about this, let me just have a disclaimer and full disclosure at the beginning. I'm an equal opportunity critic. I criticize all political parties. I do make some offhanded comments, which I often regret, but it's towards everybody. So if I criticize conservatives, know that I've criticized the NDP, the liberals, whoever's in power. I've been in the opposition most of my vocational life, so you'll forgive me that. So I don't mean to offend people. I do mean to provoke you, though. I want you to think differently about some of these things, and I will try, hopefully by the end of the day, that we can do that. I also want to say that I'm here to learn from you, because a lot of the things I think about in this notion of public theology and the role of faith groups in the public, I need to hear back from people like you. Well, what's the lived reality in your part of the world here? What are the kinds of things you're doing from your faith perspective? And I think this is very important. So when I put some of my ideas out there, it's not meant to be prescriptive. I mean, you always have to be suspicious of people coming from the East, you know what I mean, bearing gifts, so to speak. So I don't want to fall into that kind of trap. But I do want to put some ideas out there. I'd like to hear how they resonate with your part of the world and your faith community and your experience here. So that's partly what I hope we can accomplish today. Just a little outline of the choreography of the day, what we're going to do. This morning, as you can see, it's a little washed out, but my apologies for that. But we're going to talk about why a new public theology is necessary for Canada. And I'm going to speak out of a Lutheran case study of one Lutheran approach. But I will be referring to some of your traditions, and I hope you'll see them in there, and you'll see what I mean when we get to those parts. I think there's some relevance. But I am speaking as a person out of a Lutheran theological frame, and looking at how that's been expressed in a kind of public theology in Canada. And I'll say more about what I mean by public theology in a minute. We'll spend some time, I'll do a bit of a presentation, we'll spend some time talking in some table groups a little bit about that among yourselves. Then we'll have a break too, by the way. There will be a potty break or whatever at the appropriate time. And then we'll have lunch, and then after lunch we'll be looking at the question of faithful citizenship. And here the question that I asked a number of years ago and have been interested in for a long time is, what are the expectations of people of faith by expectations do politicians have of whether churches and faith groups should be involved in public life? So I'm going to try and share some views on that as with you, and we'll talk a little bit about that, and then we're going to conclude in the afternoon, I think at 3:30, right? Yeah, good. So, okay, you with me? Everybody, all right, let's hang on for the ride. So why don't we go to the first slide, and we'll take a look. So one of the things I think for Christians, the question always is one of identity. And this is the question that Jesus asked of his disciples. Who do they say that I am? Who do you say that I am? This is a question that I think is the front and center. When we talk about our role in public, we need to know who we are. And I'll be honest with you, I'm not a no-name generic kind of Christian. One of the things I've learned from Muslims and the Jewish community and Buddhists and Hindus, I spent 10 years on a committee that oversaw chaplaincy, developed policies for chaplains in public institutions in Ontario. This is a government-appointed committee. One of the things I learned from the non-Christian faith groups is they didn't want the Dave Nichols version of Christianity. They wanted you to be fully who you are so they could have an authentic relationship with you, with your community, with who you are. We need to think in those terms, particularly those of us from the Christian community, to be able to express that. Who is Jesus for you? What does your faith community mean for you, your church mean for you? And how is that going to be engaged in the world? One of my deans, the dean when I was in the seminary, used to say Christians shouldn't be so heavenly minded, they're no earthly good. And I think there's a certain reality of this that we need to understand how it is our faith community needs to engage the world. And I think, unfortunately, in some cases, we've been pretty insular as churches that have been attacked. And by the way, this hasn't been all our own fault. We've been placed in this role, too, in some cases by the context in which we live, the public cynicism, the skepticism, and all that about people of faith. One of the quotes I like when I was in Central America in El Salvador, you may have remembered that the 6 Jesuits and 2 women who were brutally killed by the military dictatorship there quite a number of years ago at the University of Central America. The 2 people replaced them. One was Michael Cherney, who was a Jesuit from Canada. The other was Dean Brackley, who was a Jesuit. And they took over in the university. He had a really tough job of restoring that whole institution and trying to bring about some ability of it to get back on its feet after such tragedy and horror. And we met with Dean Brackley, and he had a great line. He said, you know, the problem in North America is you don't know who you are. There's the quote actually is, there's a low-grade state of confusion about who we are. But for the Salvadoran campesino, which is where we were and who we were visiting, they know exactly who they are. And one of the most powerful experiences for me was sitting in a little refugee camp called Fe Esperanza during one of my visits to El Salvador, having people who by our standards would be considered illiterate talk for 3 hours with me and a Roman Catholic bishop, Jack O'Mara, about the Bible and theology. And you know, it's phenomenal, the theological literacy of people who by our standards, we would say, well, didn't have much education. And I think this is something that's instructive for us today. Today, Christianity is growing, and faith, religion, is growing throughout the world in every place except North America and Europe, Northern Europe. And we need to recognize that. Right? We have a lot to learn. The pictures you see here, unfortunately, didn't come out, but that's Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Some of you know who Dietrich Bonhoeffer was. Who resisted the Third Reich, was implicated in a plot to assassinate Hitler, and was executed about 4 or 5 days before the end of the war, a week before the end of the war. The other picture, but what's interesting is the picture below is St. Nicholas Church in Leipzig, which is where the resistance to the GDR regime began. It began with prayer services for peace that spilled over into huge demonstrations which eventually brought down the East German regime. And what is very interesting, actually we're going back there in August on a study tour. If you're interested, you can speak to me about it. The study tour will be on the theme of Reformation, Resistance, and Renewal. Luther, Bonhoeffer, and the East German Church. Why the East German Church? Because they had to resist the state and resist the communist regime. Now, when I say this, people love this because we're talking about communists. You know, it's like in the church, they want you to preach about the pagans because we don't have many around here, and it's kind of safe, you know what I mean, that they're out there somewhere or whatever. But we need to watch that in this case. But the East German church needed to resist the GDR regime, because it was always trying to impose itself and eliminate the church in terms of its public presence. So, for example, the members of the church often didn't get jobs. They didn't get the jobs. They didn't get promoted. They had a difficult time. When their kids were in school, they didn't want their children to join the communist youth organization, and so they were discriminated. Their children were often discriminated, and they were harassed. They resisted compulsory military service and all those kinds of things. You get the picture. When the wall came down, they had a huge shock. They had a state church in Germany that all of a sudden had military chapels, right? They had religious instruction in the school. It was a total cultural shift for them. And they had to adjust and think differently about their whole sort of theological frame, about how they existed, what they did. And we have a lot to learn from these kinds of folks about how it is we get seduced in the public arena and what kind of public role we need to have. And I think there's a lot of lessons for us in that as well. What I want to talk a little bit about is how the world has changed. I'm just going to say some general themes about this. I know David Suzuki and company, Ed was telling me, he was just down the street yesterday speaking, and there's other people talking about some of these important issues. But I think we as people of faith cannot talk about faith abstracted from our context. We need to understand the context in which we're living and how the faith gets expressed. And there are at least four things that I want to mention here. One of the things for the ELCIC folks, which is kind of interesting, is the observation that we went national when the world went global, didn't we? 1986, right? We became a national Lutheran church, for those of you who are Lutherans. In the 1980s was when globalization took off. And so what does that say about our understanding of the context? How does that impact? Don knows a little bit about this. Not to say we shouldn't have done it, but what does that mean for our church when we have a national church in a globalized world, when national boundaries don't mean the same things that they used to in the same ways? So, but some of the dynamics. One is we've had neoliberal economic policies. Now, by that, when I say neoliberal economic policy, what do I mean? Anybody have an idea? What's a neoliberal economic policy? What's one policy that we're referring to? Anybody know?
I think free trade.
Sure, yeah.
Small government,
yeah.
Reduction of taxes.
Yeah, taxes. Yeah. Well, it's known as the Washington Consensus, the Ten Commandments of Economic Globalization: less taxes, more investment, free trade, less regulation, all these things. And by the way, this is not liberal in the political party sense of the word. This is liberal in the sort of 18th century understanding, where you allow markets to make decisions, that you liberate markets to make these choices. And as I said in the past, and I know some of you looked on the website, some of the articles I've written, one of the problems is neoliberal economic policies have been, their results have been at best ambiguous. In fact, probably not. John Kenneth Galbraith, one of my economic heroes, used to say that all these sort of trade and these proposals always promise, everything and don't deliver very much. And there's been a sense in which that's been true about many of the trade policies and all these kinds of promises that neoliberal economic policies have offered. We've had a kind of consumer monoculture. You can go anywhere in the world and find a McDonald's, right? Two daughters, we used to have a little game going, what would you call a Big Mac in Japan or Germany? Would it be a Rosa helmet? I don't know. But no, it's called a Big Mac. The reality is, right? We have a very standardized consumer culture. And by the way, this is not all bad. There are some good things out of all of these things. So don't hear me as being just a negative totally on it. But one of the things is we have been made what? We are now taxpayers and consumers. And I may say this a couple of times. I'm really put off by that. If I hear one more finance minister talk about me as a taxpayer, I'm not a taxpayer. I am a citizen. And I am neighbor to a lot of people, whether across the street or around the world. And we need to kind of reclaim that kind of language. But this whole notion of a kind of consumer monoculture that everybody wants to buy the same thing. Ecologization. Everything's going green, whether it's going green or not. Some of you are more attuned to these issues than I am. But everybody's trying to look green, like they're ecologically responsible, right? And some of these things, they're almost amusing, right? And this is certainly another trend. The last one I would say is we have warrior nations and police states. And I'm not saying this in the kind of some of the traditional sense, but when you look at the way we've militarized international relationships, we hear very little about diplomacy anymore. In fact, I was reading the Globe this morning, that one of the things, the criticism of Obama, was that he looked weak on Syria and Putin. Now, Putin is not necessarily someone we want to hold up as a great role model for anything, but Putin sort of outmaneuvered Obama because he pulled off this agreement around chemical weapons in Syria, right? Well, it was a diplomatic solution. Certainly, some of these things ought to be more preferred than sort of just flying a bunch of F-16s over there and bombing a bunch of people. Or worst case yet, sending a bunch of drones over there and bombing a bunch of people, right? This is clearly a reflection. Now, we look at the role of police. And by the way, don't misunderstand me. I have a great deal of respect for police who put themselves in harm's way and all those kinds of things, who try to do the best they can, and they're by far and away honorable people. But my concern here is we're expecting of the military and the police more than we should.
They should play an important role in our society, but they shouldn't be elevated to a role that's somewhat more exclusionary of other ventures. Community policing, as I talked to some of the police officers I know and some of the folks who've been deeply involved in that, is not as gaining the kind of traction it once had. We're getting, and we look at all the other flagrant abuses that take place, very high-profile ones, should be worrisome for us. These are some of the kinds of impulses that are out there that we need to be mindful of. There's also been a Canadian revolution, and we need to understand it, particularly as people of faith. Peter Newman's written this book, and it's a very interesting thesis that he has. During the decade under review, 1985 to 95, Canadians individually and collectively lost common cause with their institutions. Divorced from their sense of God, King, and country, thus separated from their sense of religion, monarchy, and the land, Canadians carried their own cross, wore their own crown, and held their own orb. Canadians have moved from a position of deference to authority to defiance of it. And we see that all the time. And let's be clear, in the midst of this Senate scandal, I was listening to some commentators talk about, well, people are getting re-engaged in politics. I don't think so, folks. I think they are even more defiant of people who seem to have abused the public trust. Whether it's true or not, and yet to be proved, I hasten to add. So this is also true for religious people as well, and religious leaders. And if you're a bishop, you know this. If you're a moderator, you know this. If you're a pastor, you know this in your congregation. You need to earn your authority. You can't expect it. And this is a huge change. Some people have adjusted to this. And by the way, this may be a very good thing. I think people do need to earn authority and their credibility. You know, we need confidence-building measures. We need things that build trust, and these are very important to us. One of the United Church people, somebody was from the United Church here, mentioned Keith Howard had a great line. He says, Canada is a nation of believers, not belongers. And this is one of the outcomes, I think, of the Canadian Revolution. So now you can't see this, but anyway, I'll try and read it for you. Maybe you can see a little bit. I do apologize for this. For churches, particularly for Christians, one of my colleagues, Mark Harris, some of you know, has made the observation, we've confused membership with discipleship. And this is, I think, one of the first things that when we think about who am I, when Jesus asks that question, and we think, who am I as a Christian? When we ask that question of ourselves, we need to think about what does it mean to be disciples, followers in this regard. Churches have faced a huge challenge. The first is the demographic crisis. The numbers are going down, right? We see churches that are going to be closing, that have fewer people. The financial crisis. In the ecumenical world, every church goes through restructuring. It's almost like a liturgical rite of passage. Every spring, there's another reorganization adventure. It seems like that's pretty prominent as well. And thirdly, the loss of public credibility and respectability. I mean, today, Stephen Carter of Yale University, a lawyer, wrote an interesting book called The Culture of Disbelief. And his thesis is to say that we live in a culture that if you're a religious person, you're seen as kind of intellectually inferior, somehow emotionally and intellectually crippled. And you're not taken seriously. And very interesting, very prominent writers, Doug Saunders, Margaret Wente, others in the chattering class, have written sort of and reflected these kind of prejudices. If you're in a university, you can also see it too. Universities are the ones who create knowledge. And so as a result, religious people of faith, are often seen as, well, they're a little too superstitious, believe in myths and, you know, sort of this fantasy world. But and I think this is something that is highly problematic because, in fact, it misses a huge wealth and richness that people of faith bring. For example, my argument to my academic colleagues is, you know, you're right, but there's a lot of hubris if you think that you are the creators of knowledge. I mean, or even determining what knowledge is. At best, We're lucky as people of faith. We discover knowledge. And by that I mean, when we get, you've had this in your life probably, you know, you think you're the person of faith, you're coming to a situation, you're going to bring sort of hope and all that kind of stuff, and you arrive only to discover that God was there ahead of you. This is the approach that we take with knowledge, is in fact that when we, in fact, why did churches, why did the religious community create universities? They founded most of them in this country. They founded many of them in Europe. They were originally cathedral schools and the like. And why did they, and they were innovators. They were people who innovated in terms of technology and all these things as well. Why did they do that? Because God was incarnate in the world and they needed to know what science was about, mathematics and all these things, so they could see where God was at work in the world and recover the sense of awe, wonder, and mystery about it. That is a key thing. And so I think we need to, in our society, think about and to push back where this is where public theology, I think, can play a very helpful role. The last thing which you can't see here is that the result of these sort of things has been what my colleague David Seljak is at St. Jerome's University, Roman Catholic sociologist, has described as a discourse of loss. There's a demoralization among people of faith. You know, you kind of, and you can feel the kind of angst often, you know, when you go to meetings, and you know, and people sort of get a little bit reluctant, and they're sad about where their church or their congregation or their parish is at. They're sad about the situation of their church. They're not very hopeful about it, and they're not very joy-filled anymore. And yet, you know, think about it. I like being with Christian people. I like being in many of the multi-faith relationships I have. We have a multi-faith dialogue, two actually, that go on at the seminary I'm at. One's the Abrahamic Faith Dialogue, which involves Jewish, Christian, and Muslims, meets twice a year. We have a dialogue on Aboriginal spirituality, which meets twice a year, which involves traditional historic churches and sort of evangelical churches from the First Nations communities. And I like being with those people. I mean, forget the content. They are kind of interesting folks to be with. And if you think about your own congregation, I mean, listen, some people always have a whole list of grievances. I'm not much interested in the grievances anymore. At my age, my list is about five times as long as any of yours in this room, right? And so, I mean, I've been involved, and I've probably got people who have grievances against me, too. But the issue is to think about the things that give you life and joy in those communities. I speak, I have spoken, I shouldn't say I get a lot of invitations anymore in the current climate, but I've spoken to writing associations, other social organizations, and, you know, we in churches and faith groups need to treasure what we have in those relationships. There's a lot of fun in churches. Lutherans love to eat, you know. It shows, too. Pretty evident when you see a lot of Lutherans together. But the reality is, people have a lot of fun together, and we need to hold up those moments and remind ourselves of that to fight against this discourse of loss, this demoralization thing. So there is a theological crisis, in my view. For Christians, the kind of language we would use is the Holy Spirit trying to tell us something. You know, I think in the multi-faith community, we have issues around this as well. What's the religious moment, the theological moment in all of the traditions? For some traditions, especially new immigrant communities, we hear a lot about how fast the Muslim community is growing, or Hindu community, or these communities are growing. If you look at the sociological numbers, I'll show you some of those later in the day. In fact, the only church that is growing in Canada of the historic churches is the Roman Catholic community, and it's growing. Why? One reason. Immigration. More specifically, Filipinos. I mean, there's a lot of Filipinos here, and they go, and they stay involved in a lot of these parishes in Toronto. Many of these parishes are reinventing themselves around these kind of ethnic communities. We need to think about what is this moment? What are we moving from? And I would say we're moving from a more vertical view of our faith to one that also looks laterally to say, how do we care for the earth? How do we care for each other? This is a kind of important thing. So what I've tried to outline here for Lutherans, and it doesn't come through quite so well, but is the different theological trends that we have. and the dominant themes. And these would probably cut across all of our Christian traditions. I'd be interested in how the Muslim tradition, I suspect in the various expressions of Islam, there are similar kinds of things to this, and my experience has been that some of the discussions have taken place that way too. But the first is the top one, which you can't read too well, is really actually more around orthodoxy and kind of confessional kind of theology. And in the Canadian circles, this was very traditional, very propositional. Right, you. This was the statement. You believed this statement. In some churches, you had creeds that were subscribed to. Theological education in that moment was very interesting too. In that period, the way it was done was the professor got a textbook, and you had to memorize what was in the textbook. The great innovation was when in the 30s and 40s, you ended up with professors who could actually lecture. This was really suspect. Why was it suspect? Because now the faculty member could interpret these original founding kind of documents in some ways. And so this was very much a propositional approach to theological education as well as to being part of a church. Now, in Canada, you know, Christian churches tend to be congenital, right? You're born into one. You don't change too easily, right? Except today, that is changing. And that's something that's very different. But this kind of orthodoxy held up. Then the next, and in terms of what our role was in the public domain, well, it was about being the kind of developing a national moral identity. Think about it. Canada is a dominion. There's a very religious motif here that traces itself back to this kind of approach, very propositional, very confessional. And the role of the faith communities, churches in particular, was to establish this national moral identity. And we had some pitched battles over that, too. Lutherans, for example, didn't fare so well in that. But we forget our own history. In my part of the world, in Markham, in Markham in particular, the members of the local Lutheran congregation were on the doorsteps with their rifles to keep the Anglicans out, you know, the whole assimilation thing, you know. So, I mean, this was not all sweetness and light, folks. We've come a long way from those days. The second era, though, was one we could describe as theological liberalism. Oh, the public theology, the public kind of theology, I should say, was the kind of building a national moral identity. The theological liberalism that came in the 19th and 20th centuries was an acceptance of the Enlightenment. How many of you heard the quest for the historical Jesus? Right? You know, this is the kind of theological themes that were approached. There were, you know, rational, reasoned, systematic theologies developed in these kinds of things. In theological education, as I mentioned, the lecture came in, so faculty now started engaged in this kind of thing. But World War I and World War II shattered the illusion of theological liberalism, and most notably what was known as the Shoah for Jewish people, or the Holocaust as it's more commonly referred to, shattered the optimism that theological liberalism had. Theological liberalism was about building a better world. We were getting better. We were knowing more. We could understand God's will for our lives, and we could, you know, there was progress, theological progress. Well, we got to World War II, the Holocaust, and what did we discover? That we're just the same kind of people we always were. Fallen, depraved, and broken in many ways. Capable of horrendous evil. And this was a huge shock to the liberal theological establishment. Now, when I'm talking about theological liberalism, I'm not talking about people like me. I've been labeled as a kind of theological liberal, and you probably know people that are liberals, or maybe you identify as. This is not what we're talking about in liberalism, theological liberalism. We're talking about in a more traditional sense. The next yellow one that you can't read is the social gospel movement. And the United Church, very, very, very much involved in the whole social gospel movement, for better and for worse, I might add. You know, a lot of my sort of more progressive friends link the social gospel to things like Woodsworth and the fight against poverty and all these kinds of issues, the development, the evolution of the CCF and healthcare and all that. But bear in mind, there was also the other side of it, temperance, prohibition, the blue laws, you know, which you couldn't do things on Sundays, stuff like this. It was a mixed bag. But one of the things about the social gospel movement, which is very important, was they took seriously the public theological role of saying we have to address some of these issues. And remember Canada in that time. Canada was moving from an agrarian kind of society. People lived on the farm. But there was a mass migration into the cities, and these were being industrialized, and they were coming with all kinds of social and familial problems that were evolving. And so the social gospel movement was really a genuine attempt to kind of rectify and address these kind of problems that were plaguing Canadian cities in Canada. And so the social gospel movement had a public theology of building the reign of God here and now, and trying to make Canada a Christian nation in that sense, a more just and humane place. Coming along then in the early 20th century, we had what I would call a unity theology. And Christians have been big on unity. Christian unity. How many of you heard of Christian unity? Let's just take a little poll there, right? Come on, more of you have heard of that, right? This is a big thing for us, right? We have prayer for Christian unity. We have a week for Christian unity. We do all kinds of... Christian unity is a big, big deal for Christians. That all may be one. That's what Jesus prayed. And in fact, this has been important. Well, this has translated itself into a public theology of pulling churches notably together. We didn't have a lot of other faith groups at the time. In fact, we may have had problematic attitudes towards other faith groups even in this period. But you had all these kind of union movements, the church union movement. The Anglican United Church was trying to form a church union. United Church was formed as a church union between Presbyterians and Methodists and Congregationalists. The Anglicans and United Church eventually tried Lutherans. Lutherans had a union movement. We were quite a variety of... how many church bodies were there in the early part of
age?
Eight. And so these have now merged down there to probably two or three principal ones in Canada. This was a major initiative. And the church the unity movement also expressed itself in some other ways. It expressed itself in the creation of ecumenical institutions. When I talk about ecumenical, I'm talking about Christian relationships between churches. We refer to multi-faith when we're talking about relationships between Christian churches and other faiths, non-Christian faiths. But the ecumenical movement was a major reflection of this unity initiative. And there were actually two streams of the ecumenical movement. There's the faith and order kind of movement. How many of you have heard of the theological dialogues? And this is your cue. Yeah, right. The Anglican-Lutheran dialogue, the Lutheran-Mennonite dialogue is another one. There have been we had dialogues with seven, where you have theological conversations to see if you can find certain agreements, and then you come to an agreement and then try to do some things together. That was one stream, and that's reflective of this kind of unity theology, too, trying to pull the diverse parts of the Christian community together. And then the other was the life and work movement of the ecumenical world. And that came to sort of how do you connect with social justice issues and things like that. How many of you know about ecumenical coalitions? Have you, any of you worked with some of the ecumenical coalitions? 10 Days for Global World Development, EcEdge, Gadfly, Project North was big here, the Church Council on Justice and Corrections. These were all reflective of a unity theology, too. The last one over here, I would say, in sort of the dominant themes, is what we would call a liberationist approach. And here, one of the most prominent examples is liberation theology, primarily out of Latin America, people like Gustavo Gutierrez. There were people who wrote in this tradition in Canada, too. I'll say a little bit about that as well. But these were liberationist movements that, in fact, there was a liberation ethics to address the structural injustices within a society the public theology was designed to deal with. And many of the ecumenical coalitions, much of the work of the Canadian Council's Commission on Justice and Peace, which I was part of at one point, reflected this kind of liberationist view. Not everybody was a liberation theologian who is in this theological camp. There were various expressions. Some of the Roman Catholic religious orders, for example, very much adopted a liberation theology approach. The Canadian Conference of Catholic Bishops took much more of a liberationist view. There were a lot of social teaching statements that came out. Lutherans, for example, were always suspicious of sort of liberation, anything where we Christianize society, because we don't, that implied a sort of redemptive nature to the activity towards society, and we were always reluctant about that. But there was a liberation ethic that was committed to saying, yeah, we have responsibilities. And Lutherans would do well to remember, we've had a very quietistic history in this regard, but Lutherans would do well to remember that both Philip Melanchthon, who redesigned the entire education system in Germany, he was known as Germany's teacher, and that was both in Roman Catholic and Lutheran jurisdictions, was very much committed to sort of liberating and changing the structures, the social structures. Luther himself designed the welfare legislation around the thing called the community chest for all of the cities in Europe that was adopted by pretty much all of them, again, in various religious jurisdictions, Roman Catholic and Lutheran as well. So these liberationist impulses were not just liberation theology. I want to mention, and it wasn't that there was a parallel movement here evolving around feminist theology. Some of you are aware of this feminist theology, which was important and I think brought a very rich dimension to the rest of those theological perspectives. And by the way, these are not mutually exclusive. People probably found they kind of overlap. And if you're in a denomination and you see, you can see how these things get played out in your own church. You can see certain people when I used to watch at the convention. I know in Don and Larry at your church convention, you probably see people go up and make statements. I hope you can see some of these kind of theological orientations that came out in what people said, what people write when they write to the Anglican Journal or, make interventions. You see these theological threads being played out, and sometimes, a couple of them, but they've evolved over time. And the feminist womanist theology was also an important part of that. Why don't we go to the next one? I'm not going to say much about the Lutherans in this sense, but for Lutheranism, we had similar trends. You'll notice that the social gospel one was not as prominent. I'll say something about that in a minute. But there was orthodoxy. And these were some of the people from the eastern part of the church who were involved in these movements. I'd be interested in hearing from you. I know some of the people like Bill Hordern and Roger Nussbaum and some of the other folks. I'd be interested in hearing from some of you a little bit more about who these the people were that were representative. Or if there was another stream, I think there's Haugianism and Pietism out here that is also a major factor that needs to be considered. Orthodoxy was a major thing. C.H. Little, who was at Waterloo, I mean, by our standards today, he would have been in the right wing of the Missouri Synod, if that's helpful to some Lutherans as a kind of geographical locator. He published in the St. Louis Publishing House. I mean, this was he was very much a conservative, confessional, propositional, orthodox kind of theological presence. Otto Heike came along. Otto Heike was a very interesting person because he came at this time when you faculty started to lecture, right? And one of his big claims to fame was to engage liberalism. He really wanted to engage theological liberalism in a dialogue with the Lutheran tradition. He wasn't a liberal himself, but he saw that as important, and that was important. Then we ended up with a kind of pastoral theology. The two people that are significant here were Arne Cyril and Delton Glebe. This was when Delton Glebe was actually the dean when I was in seminary, who said we shouldn't be so heavenly minded, we're no earthly good. Actually pioneered pastoral care and practical ministry. And so in seminaries, you started finding ministers who were being trained in the practice of ministry, doing something. And there were a range of sort of what I call pop, non, and anti-theological religious impulses there as well throughout this period. These are some of the people. We also, in the Lutheran camp, were very much caught up in a unity theology. And as some of you who worked very hard on bringing about the formation of the ELCIC, this was one final consummate expression of a unity theology, bringing Lutherans together, healing the breaches that had taken place historically. And in some sense, what I guess I'm suggesting at this point is the question is, are we hanging on too long to a unity theology? Do we need to move to a new form of public theology that's important? And that's where I'm going with this. We can go to the next slide. There were some minor themes I mentioned here, not the least of which was the social gospel movement. The English Synod, there was the German Synod and the English Synod in Eastern Canada. The English-speaking Synod was very much involved in the social gospel movement. Eventually, these were merged to form one synod, diocese, conference kind of thing. And so that whole impulse was kind of lost. But one of the key people here was Niels Wilson, who, by the way, also helped found the Lutheran School of Theology in Saskatoon. Right? And he was very noted and had a very national presence. Some people dealing with feminist, womanist, and liberation theology, Oscar Arnell has written extensively on this, and there were a number of people in that stream as well. And I hope you start to think about some of the people out of your own traditions who have written and thought about these things as well. Go ahead. So you can't see this, but these are two dinosaurs on a rock, and say the ark is sailing off, and they say, "Oh, is that supposed to be today?" The bad news is for churches that we're history. And Reginald Bibby talks about this. He says, "I look at the four primary firms in this grouping, the historic churches, mainly Anglican, United, Lutheran and Presbyterian. The research findings, everybody know who Reginald Bibby is? He teaches at Lethbridge. He's a sociologist of risen religion. He's tracked a lot of these numbers. We're going to look at some of his insights for this moment. And he said the research findings point to the reality that it would not surprise any of them. It is difficult to see much hope for a viable future. This is the theological moment for us, folks. What is it that we're going to become in the light of these kind of impulses? Which means that theological history I just sketched out and the sort of global context we're living in and all of these things, this has brought us to this point. So what is this point? Where do we go from here? By the way, it's not all bad news. Hopefully by the end of the day we'll get to the good news. I think there's some real sources of optimism here, but let's get there. Go ahead. So the question is, one of my colleagues, Tony Clark, some of you may know, used to be at the Catholic Bishops Conference, the staff of the Social Affairs Commission, said, "What you see depends on where you're standing." And I would say, given that it's Reformation Day, I'm not going to tack anything on a wall. There's a poster, I should have used the picture of it. It has a poster of Luther, and it says, "Whenever I put something on a door, stuff happens," right? So. But I'm not suggesting that. What I am suggesting, though, is we need to change the channel. We need to employ a different lens by which to look at the world and shift our thinking and doing as churches, what it is we're going to be about. People are reading us like a book, and you'll see there is a renewed interest in things spiritual and religious. People are interested in this stuff. But what what's changing... the interest, the market hasn't changed, but the providers will change. This is what Reg Fibby's point is. So where do we begin? Let's go to the next slide. Bibby makes some very important points, and I'm going to make a few of those now. The good news about religion in Canada is... one thing that Reg Bibby says, which I think is very important, is one of the quotes he often has, is there are certain questions... only the gods can answer, right? These are religious questions. These are profound theological questions, and they're like what I call life questions. 95% of the questions we ask are not particularly germane. They're kind of incidental, but there are those 5% of questions that we ask ourselves that go right to the heart of who we are. What do I do with my life? Who am I? These are ultimate questions, and they often arise in the midst of a life crisis, right? Those of you who are pastors, you have a privileged moment, right? You're often in on these things when someone dies, or someone's getting married, or a child's being baptized, or someone's in a hospital with an illness, or they lose a job. Go down the list. These are theological moments. We don't wish them for anybody, but they happen. And in those theological moments, we ask profound life questions. And these life questions are only questions that the gods can answer, or for Christians, our God can answer. So what Bibby makes some observation. Religion's not gone away in Canada. Canadians remain largely pro-God and pro-organized religion. They're open to churches. They're open to mosques, temples. They're very favorably disposed. They don't necessarily go, but they're favorably disposed. Christianity is still the dominant faith group in Canada. 72% of Canadians self-identify as Christians. And yes, it's true. Non-Christian groups are growing quickly, but overwhelmingly, if you're a large part of the population and you grow just a little bit, you know, your absolute numbers may be large, but your percentage growth may be small. And oftentimes commentators in the press pick on these kind of numbers and kind of in a sense misrepresent this in a way. Large numbers of young people are open to greater religious involvement. One of the studies I was looking at one point, you know, we often, in the historic churches, people say, well, their kids don't go to church, and so you're losing this whole generation, and then the next generation is going to be lost for sure. But in point of fact, there's a kind of interest in that generation in a different way. They don't know what to do with it. But it's not an open hostility. It's not all bad news. There may be a moment. If you're on campus, there are groups that are out reaching out to these folks already. And it may not be the theological orientation I particularly like or believe or in my age have come to, but in point of fact, the interest is there, which is one of the reasons why at the seminary I'm at, we started an undergraduate program in Christian Studies and Global Citizenship to address specifically that kind of need. That you can be a person of faith and can find not just a job. A lot of people go to university to find a job, but you can find your life's work. This is important. And large numbers of young people anticipate having religious figures carry out key rites of passage, wedding, funeral, birth-related kinds of things. You can see here the degree of Canadian religiosity. This is over 10 years old now. But the StatsCan looked at four measures, religious attendance, religious affiliation, personal religious activities, and those who said religion is important to them. And they came up with a religiosity index of which you look at the overall numbers. Is that, you know, by far and away a large majority have a high degree of religiosity, are very open to the kind of religion. They're just not necessarily interested in the kinds of things that the religious institutions we have in place are offering. So I won't say more about that. We can talk about it a little bit later. Religious practices. I'm just going to mention the top thing. You can read some of the details. This is a significant thing. One in five adults who infrequently engage or never attend religious services, they don't go to temple, mosque, church, or anything, one in five do regular religious practices on their own. That is, they pray, they have some activities, those kinds of things. So it's not that people are hostile necessarily as well. Okay, we're going to keep going. So the good news that Bibby says is the gods are back. And he argues that polarization, not secularization, is the problem. And this is very important for us when we start thinking about the kind of public theology that I think we need. Secularization argues that the secularization thesis is that the more a society is educated and more affluent a society, religion becomes less and less important, right? You've heard of this? Canada's a secular society. Regularly in the papers, people buy into this quite well. But the reality is the secularization thesis is not true. The evidence is starting to show that it's not true at all. Once it was thought that the United States was an exception, right? Because it's a highly developed, highly affluent, highly educated country, and still religion plays a very predominant role there, for better or worse in some cases. So this was attributed to what was called American exceptionalism, right? That this was the exception to the rule. And in fact, what we see today is, in fact, no, the exceptions may be Canada and Europe, because religion is growing everywhere around the world, even in more affluent societies as well. So the secularization thesis is not necessarily, and some people who were, Peter Berger and others who wrote on this, have said, no, we don't subscribe to that anymore. But there is a polarization within faith, right? Separation, people in very divergent positions on these things. And I think this is what Bibby argues is important. And so one of the questions becomes, if we develop a public theology, how do how do we cross the borders or the boundaries that separate people here? He's found that religion makes no difference regarding personal well-being and spiritual needs. There are other sources that can do this. It can. I mean, religion can play a role in this in some ways, but this is not the dominant thing. But religion does make a difference around social well-being, around compassion and civility, and it does make a difference on the life questions, death, and those ultimate questions we refer to later. So the question I would suggest is one of belonging. That really today, whereas it might have been unity in the recent past, we have to ask the question, what does it mean to belong today? What does it mean to belong in our society? What does it mean to belong in our churches? We need to think differently about these things. I've said many times that I think the greatest social illness we're facing in this country today is a kind of profound existential and practical loneliness. They don't matter to anybody. And if we know anything about things, we know something about including people in communities. In fact, David Selgin, in his work, what he does offer as a hopeful sign for Lutherans is our work around immigration. We know something about bringing refugees to this country, right? Lutherans do. Others do as well, other church traditions. But that's an example of how you bring someone into the community. I did a talk at Camrose and I last night, and one of the things I was talking about was John Ralston Stahl's book about he argues that Canada is really a Métis nation, Aboriginal nation, that we need to look to those roots, not to the English and French as the founding nations. Because when we look at what Canada is about, the Aboriginal view is that you have a circle, and the trick is always to include more people, right? You get the circle grows, and that's Canada, right? We've always got room for one more group of boat people, one more group of refugees, one more people fleeing oppression, one more group of people that have been left out somewhere in the world. The least, the lost, and the forgotten, they can come here, at least until recently. And I think this is something we need to start thinking about in a big way. Bonhoeffer's written about this, but the fellow you may not know is Manfred Max Neef. He's a Chilean economist, and he's got this is a great quote. I use it a lot because I think it says something very important. Never in human history has been there such an accumulation of knowledge like in the last 100 years. So this is a big thing, you know, the discovery of knowledge, the creation of knowledge. We're the information society now. But the point is that knowledge alone is not enough. We lack understanding. When you belong, you understand. When you're separated, you can accumulate knowledge. And that's been the function of science. Now, science is divided into parts, but understanding is holistic. And that is the task, a theological task, the task of a public theology. We'll go to the next one. So I want to just clarify a little bit about public theology, and then we'll close with that, and we'll have a chance to take a little break. You probably heard these terms, civil religion in the United States. Civil religion is the projection of a cultural experience and values onto the cosmic order for the sake of social solidarity. So, you know, God bless America at the end of every speech is a cultural projection, making it an ultimate kind of thing in which everybody can kind of buy into. It has a bit of a divine sanction that's from the culture upward. Political theology, which is a kind of European creation, is really the seeking of a kind of state power to either secure or radically transform the state's purposes in accordance with divine intentions. It's a top-down approach, too. It's kind of Christianizing the nation, right? If we could just, you know, get Christians running the whole show, for example, that would be... Or, it doesn't matter, I'll talk more about that this afternoon, a little bit about the role of theocracies, but... This is what we talk about in terms of political theology. Public theology is different. Public theology is kind of from the center out. And what it's about is it arises from those kind of convictions that we have as people of faith and how we relate to the res publica, the public purpose. What do we out of our faith traditions, whether they're Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, whatever, what's the public purpose that emanates out of those faith convictions? And that's a little bit different. Go ahead. Jürgen Moltmann has given this definition of public theology. It thinks about what is the general concern in the light of hope in Christ for the kingdom of God. It becomes political in the name of the poor and marginalized in a given society. Remembrance of the crucified Christ makes it critical toward political, religious, and religious ideologies. It thinks critically about religious and moral values of society in which it exists and presents its reflections as a reasoned position. So we're going to skip through these. These are some of the life questions, I think, that are on the minds of people. We have Christian responses. We also have responses that come out of our new economic theology that governs a lot of what we're doing. You can go to the next slide, Rebecca, and the next one, too. But what I want to talk about in conclusion is that this reality points us to the need for what I call a theology of belonging. It means that we, as people of faith, need to articulate and exemplify lives of radical gratitude. We've been given a lot, and how do we live thankfully out of it? It is that we are communities of extreme hospitality and accompaniment. It's not that we have all the answers. Sometimes, and you know this in your own life, right? In life, when life has really been down on you and you face some really, really tough moment, what was important was that somebody showed up. Right? Somebody was there. Not what they said, necessarily. Maybe it helped a bit. Maybe it was good. But the first thing that really helped you was showing up. One of the other things is, in terms of belonging, is when someone's extended to you hospitality, brought you into their home. And in fact, when we think about First Nations, I heard an Aboriginal leader once talk about this in a way. He said, you know, when Europeans arrived, you know, it's like they came to our house, and they came into the living room, and so eventually kind of took over the living room, and we moved into the kitchen, and they eventually took over the kitchen, and then we moved upstairs into the bedroom, and they eventually came up into the bedroom. They eventually colonized the house till we ended up in the closet, which we call a reserve, right? In a sense, that's not hospitality. Hospitality is how you open yourself up to welcome and embrace the other. We need to major in the major things that enhance life, not minor things. You know what? I don't know about you, but I get so tired of some of the fights that people have over stuff that's insignificant. Henry Kissinger had a great quote about universities. He said, you know why the battles on academic in the academy are so fierce and vicious is because the stakes are so low. Think about that in some of our congregations, too. I mean, we fight over some stuff that really the stakes are pretty low. So we also need to be a theology of belonging is a one that welcomes the reign of God. Do we tell the stories? You know, it's like a parade, you know, or maybe if you ever take kids to a parade, you know, and they all of a sudden they're surprised. Oh, there's the clown. There's the float, right? We need to think about point those places where God's grace is at work in the world. Think about your week this past week. You know, what you've done. Just go back over some of the events. Where did you see God's grace at work in your life, in your world? I'm not asking you to tell me. I'm just asking you to think about it. We ought to think about, that's not time we take for those things. But Christians and people of faith ought to point to those places where God's at work, marvelously at work. And we should point to those places and hold them up. These are the good news stories, the life-giving stories. And lastly, faith communities need to be committed to learning and scholarship. We have to be interesting people. The Archbishop of Canterbury, we have some angry, Rowan Williams was at the last LWF assembly, and he had a great line. He said, you know, 2,000 years of Christianity, we've taken something so wonderful, so powerful, so life-giving, and we've made it so boring. How are we enhancing life? That's the bottom line. Peter Drucker, a consultant, management consultant, well-known and done a lot of work in the not-for-profit sector, said, the bottom line for voluntary organizations like faith groups is changed lives. So we should be measuring, the metric we should be measuring the effectiveness of our ministry by is not, you know, the offerings, not the attendance, but how have we changed people's lives? And we ought to be attentive to watch where that's happening. Well, anyway, I think at this point, what I'd like to ask you to do, so we're going to take a break, and so you can stretch. I'm sorry, we went a little longer than I planned. We'll take a bit of a break, and then we're going to come back and we're going to discuss some of these questions around the table. Okay, so thank you for that. So let's take a break, get some coffee. We'll take maybe, 15 minutes, and then we'll come back with some discussion around the tables, okay? We're not going to have everything you talked about reported out here, but it might be helpful to hear a little bit of the flavor of the kinds of conversations you had. So so maybe we could start with this table. If you have something, you would like to. Yeah, maybe. Why don't you scoot up here? Just.
Well, I'm not going to be linear about this. This is kind of a little bit of all of the questions, but I'll just give you a flavor of some of our conversation. One of the questions when we talked about what we're willing to give away and whatever was, how much are we inward focused on making our straggling institutions themselves survive versus how much are we willing to put time and energy into things that will enhance the greater good and the greater thriving? We made a very short list of words that we think encompass what extreme hospitality might look like, and those are words like forgiveness. Someone said try again, you know, after we mess up, which we will inevitably do. Recognize that we each have unique kinds of giftedness to offer to this enterprise. It's not going to look the same for all of us. We're not all going to work in the same sphere, in the same way. We have a historian at our table, and I think that I pointed out that even the teaching of history is, I think, a prime ground for changing minds and learning about the other and learning about what it means to be hospitable, because we don't understand that history. It's a barrier. Let's see. I think the other things we said were don't judge. the role of judgment is reserved for God, as we heard in the Quran, and also in the Christian Bible, do not judge. So, yet we're very good at judging, and many of our misunderstandings about other groups stems from judgment, and I think that leads to people feeling excluded, and this lack of belonging is just a huge misunderstandings based on prior judgments. And then seeking understanding and listening and, as another person at the table said. So that's kind of like, and oh, what kind of leader did it take? I nominate Azeem at our table and David.
Thank you. Okay, some other folks? We got somebody from here who want to say something? What was your conversation about?
Hospitality.
Can we say a little bit? Who's going to? Okay, one thing.
I think the major flavor of the discussion here is hospitality and the extreme hospitality, and we discussed around opening our churches and inviting in with no strings attached, and we talked around that quite a bit. And I think that's something we can do, and it does have payoff down the line. We don't see that now, but that's in God's hands, and that was our major discussion point. Don, thanks. Pretty close.
Yeah, okay.
Thanks. Okay, I'm looking around here. This is the time everybody starts to look at the floor, right? When I first went to the university, everybody was looking down, and I had these meetings I'd go to, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. They all had Blackberries, so it was kind of the Blackberry prayer. I thought everybody was sort of devotional, but anyway, I just didn't want to jump. Ray, do you want to say something?
Well, at our table, we got in on the discussion of what we would be prepared to give up and what we wouldn't be prepared to give up. And unanimous in agreeing on was that we wouldn't be prepared to give up our understanding of grace, which is treasured by Lutherans. Four of the five at our table were Lutherans. And that sense of inclusiveness. But I said, and I think there was some agreement, that I would be prepared to give up my Lutheran identity, provided in a new entity, a new, larger faith community, provided that grace and inclusiveness was at the center of it. If this new entity would further the sense of belonging and be more life-enhancing than our smaller Lutheran identity.
Thank you. Others want to offer a bit of the flavor? Is your hand going up, Ann?
Yeah,
come on up here. I think it's easier if you speak here than people can hear you.
We said that belonging does not mean come on in and be like us. In fact, one of the things we said, belonging isn't really about coming in at all. It's about going out. And we talked about the theology of belonging and how does discipleship, we had a big conversation about what discipleship and mission mean in the context of belonging. And then it belonging became very outwardly focused. And that was, and then we also talked about belonging as being unconditional, and that was part of it too. But the focus on discipleship and mission was really important for us.
Anybody else? You ready for the test? Okay. I'm going to ask Bishop Larry to offer a few thoughts, concluding the morning, and then we're going to break for lunch.
First of all, a thank you to David for a very engaging morning. I found, for me, I just wanted to share a few reflections, as David had asked me to do, but I found that what you were doing for me was reframing some things, particularly around the theology. Thanks, Andrea. A theology of belonging. I've been recently reading Douglas John Hall's fine book, Waiting for Gospel, which I've been encouraging our pastors to read at conference conventions. And Douglas John Hall talks about what does it mean to proclaim the gospel in this time and this place in our context. And he refers back to Tillich, who talks about one of the needs is the sense of emptiness and loneliness, which I think you've addressed this morning. So how do we respond to that as a people of faith? And I think that ties in very well with this theology of belonging. So people are asking about not so much the question of life everlasting, but the question about why should I live? What's the purpose of my life? And so the question becomes a question of vocation and a question of purpose in this life. The other thought I had, David, was in our synod and related to Anne's comments, we've been focusing on mission and missional theology, which takes us outside of the church door. And then we begin to ask two important questions. The first question is, what is God doing in the neighborhood? What is God doing out there? And then the second question is, how do we join in that doing, what God is doing, that mission? So those are some of my thoughts, some of my reflections. I think then finally, some of the words that are important for me are collaborative, discernment, I think so important, particularly listening. First of all, listening. So collaboration, discernment, discipleship, and a sense of experimentation, trying something, throwing it out there and see what happens. So thank you for the opportunity.
Okay, you ready for the test? I think at this point we're probably ready to break for some lunch.